Hello, everyone, and happy March. We have sprung forward for better or for worse. For those of us who had to work Sunday morning, it was not the best. We are enjoying a pseudo-spring here in the Midwest, and it is time for our March Pete's Cast. As always, I'm your co-host, Jason, coming to you from oddly sunny Columbus, Ohio, for an early March, and I am joined with a panel of esteemed guests. But first, I always have to say hello to my mentor and further esteemed co-host emeritus, Scott. How are you doing today?
We are just fantastic. We're in sunny Las Cruces, New Mexico, where it is in anywhere from the 70s to 80s. Not a spick of snow looking anywhere in the forecast, and so we're looking at record highs soon to be. So we're excited about having this March kind of madness. I love to call March Madness and March Match all in the same sentence, because I think it has a lot to do together.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it is 73 here today. Tuesday, there's a 50% chance of snow, so it is very short-lived. But, you know, that's March in the Midwest. But like you had already said, you know, we're filming this in, I guess we'll call it early to mid-March. But this podcast will come out in the end of March. And so that time point, all of our fourth-year students will have gone through the match. They will have had their time to celebrate, and then they have the period of what now? And so one of the best things that we can do is we thought we would bring in our very own panel of experts, because I feel like I can say that I am now too far away from the match. Scott, I think you can say you're too far away from the match. But we have three guests here who are not so far away from the match. We have our intern trustee, Dr. Madison Kraft, who is joining us from, well, if you're on the ski slopes, I'm not sure if you're in Louisville, you're joining us from somewhere. How are you doing, Dr. Kraft?
I'm doing well. I left the ski slopes. I was on vacation last week. I'm back on service at the hospital, so doing things a little differently, but back in Louisville for the foreseeable future.
All right. So why don't you remind everyone where you matched into what program?
So I matched into internal medicine and pediatrics, more commonly known as MedPeds, at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. I feel like it's very important to say, as I learned, you have to say Louisville, you can't say Louisville or Louisville, because you will get called out.
Yes, Louisville will get you definitely thrown out, but I'm glad you have mastered Louisville. And then thank you for joining us. Then we have our second year resident member with us, Dr. Jessica Kroner, joining us from Connecticut. How are you doing, Dr. Kroner?
I'm doing wonderful. Also enjoying some sunshine.
And why don't you remind us, everyone, program and what you matched into?
I matched into pediatrics at the University of Connecticut.
All right. Welcome. And you are second year, right? Yes, you're a second year. So welcome. You're in that wonderful in-between year where you don't have to be thinking about the next match. And speaking of the next match, we have our fellow trustee, who I am proud to say is joining me in my clan. You're also in the Midwest, Dr. Mackenzie LeMay. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. To do a little bit of back before my fellowship, I did general peds at the Children's Hospital of Georgia, Medical College of Georgia in Augusta. And then I matched into neonatal perinatal fellowship, more commonly known as NICU, at Riley Hospital for Children, which is in Indianapolis, which I am over halfway through, and that is terrifying.
Wow, time has flown. Yes, you are over halfway through. You're into that job search almost soon. Oh, okay.
Well, it's good to know that she's going to be really pampered here in the next year and a half. Really, you know, given the you know, gold treatment.
Anxiety, yes. Yeah. It's a different kind of match when you're looking for a job, because you have control over it, which is almost scarier.
Well, I always said, you know, at this point in time, you become a very big commodity, and there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, looking at you and wanting you to come play in their playground.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, well, I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your days. I know, like you said, Madison, you're on service and, you know, training is not easy. So thank you all for coming and joining us, but mostly, you know, for sharing your insight with our soon to be graduating medical students who are wondering what to do. And so I'm going to start with Dr. Kraft. So it's just been a year since. So, and you also had the joy of doing a couples match. So you had a lot of stuff going on. So why don't you talk about what it felt like that day of match and what you went through when you realized that you had made it to this step and you knew where you were going next?
My lovely wife is going to pass in the background behind me too, who was part of that couples match. So that week, we get the email Monday morning, we've matched. We've matched, but the couples match list for us is like, I mean, we hit 99 combos. So it was a matter of what it was. So there were a lot of feelings about how it was going to go. And then, I mean, you're sitting there you're sitting there Friday. And it says 10 o'clock. I think it actually happened at 9:50 when like the NRMP email came through and you're kind of like, oh my God. And then, you know, you're looking at each other, University of Louisville. I'm University of Louisville too. You know, just like total panic, but also excitement and just like elation. And then you're like checking in with your friends. And I mean, it's roller coaster, I don't think is like an accurate enough term, maybe like NASA launch to space, just kind of what the week feels like.
And then a free fall to Earth.
And then there's that real sweet part where you get to between July 1st and when you match, where you can say like you're a doctor, but there's not yet the crushing responsibility of it.
And that's when the parachute comes out.
Yes. And then July 1st, when you walk in the room and someone's like, we need a doctor for the med. And you go, oh, wait, that's me. So, I mean, just lots of feelings. And it's okay to feel very like conflicted too during the week too, because you're going to be with a lot of friends and family who have all been a part of that journey with you. But also, you know, your friends are also going through their own journey of matching. And it's a very, I think, like trying week for everyone, the highs and the lows. So give yourself a little bit of grace throughout the week when it comes. And by this grace, I mean a lot of grace.
Yeah. Madison, did you have any of your friends maybe not match? And how did they react? And what were kind of your words to encourage them that, you know?
Not in my class. I think we were lucky and fortunate, you know, to have a good like match for our class in terms of especially pediatrics. I didn't have an ear to sort of what was going on with maybe some of the more competitive matches. I do remember last year, a good friend of mine, his wife, her soon-to-be wife, is also in medical school and did not go as high on her list as she planned, and it was going to be a lot further from him. And some of that encouragement you give also has to be space. It's like a weird balance. You have to ride the line, and I'm not a psychology expert or give any recommendation on like when do you check in with someone versus when do you give space. But I know that, you know, we checked in with her and said, hey, we're here. If you want to talk, if you don't want to talk, like ignore it. I think you have to, when you have a friend like that or a colleague, you have to let them heal at their own pace with what goes on with match week.
Good advice.
Yes. You know, and I can, even though I am far away, I can remember. So I shared this story pretty openly. I did not match my first choice. I matched my third, and I matched my third for fellowship as well. Ironically, I now work at my first choice for residency, and I sit on the residency selection committee and the fellowship selection committee, and I'm in part of the medical leadership. So, you know, if you didn't get that first place spot, one, it's okay to be upset, but, you know, not to sound cliche, but things find a way. I ended up where I wanted to be in a long time, and you're going to get trained. So still celebrate, because you're going to make that next step. Dr. Kroner, Jess, I don't know if you want to add anything as far as your match experience, looking back on it now, if you remember that time and then between then and you in starting into residency.
Yes. It seems like a distant memory, but really is not that distant. I think One thing that I remember is I did have some friends that did not get into their, not even their top choice or their top third choice, but got into their last choice. And I think what Madison said kind of applies generally too, because on Monday, everyone knows, like, you find out if you matched, but not where. And so there's a lot of excitement that you don't have to go through that SOAP process if you match. But then you open the letter on Friday and you're potentially disappointed with where you did match. And so I think that's an interesting dynamic to battle and for friends to grapple with, because, you know, 96 hours later, you're all screaming, celebrating that you matched. But then some people are upset and some people are not. And so I think that giving that space is really important. I know for me, for those people, I kind of waited the weekend out, let them have their time. And then I Monday and was like, hey, like, I'm here if you want to chat, you know, do you need anything, etc. I think following that in between match and when you start residency is also a very weird and uncomfortable time for medical students or now doctors, because you're kind of free for the first time in your life with minimal need to study. And I think a lot of the times people can unravel during that. One thing that I found extremely difficult was grappling with the idea that I have to find a place to live in like 2 or 3 months. And not only that, but I want it to be affordable. I want it to be good to where I work. It's likely in a location that I'm not familiar with. And so I think diving into that right away was a lot of stress.
Could I ask, so you both are post-COVID matchers, when everything went virtual, what was that like, you know, doing these virtual interviews and then matching to a place? And like you said, Jess, coming to the realization, oh, I'm now going to live here for 3 years and it's going to start in 3 months. How do I do this?
Yeah, I'll say one thing is, you know, during interviews when they're virtual, they tell you, like, everybody asks, like, oh, well, where do people live? And as best as you try to, like, write down all the cities, they're just, like, rattling them off. And that can be difficult. I liked that our program kind of sent a list of cities. And then not only that, but they also, like, included places that people like to eat and different genres of food or movie theaters, that kind of thing. And so that gave us a starting point. But it's not easy still. Nowadays, or at least I know my program, so we're still virtually interviewing, but we did 2 in-person second looks this year. And I think that really made a difference for people to come and spend the weekend and actually, like, see our institution.
And I will say I'm extremely open about my MASH journey. For my residency, first of all, I was the first post-COVID match. I was 2021. Where it was like the entire season was completely virtual. Nobody knew what they were doing. Nobody knew how the best way to approach anything was, because the shutdown happened after most of all interviews had already ended for 2020. And then the match was just kind of, you matched alone. I had all virtual interviews. And honestly, from hearing all of my classmates that had done the match before and how expensive it was and all the travel and all that time away and all these extra things, I have to say it was very nice to be able to virtually interview in, like, gym shorts and then my, like, professional on top. It was the wild days of COVID. It was a different time, but it was extremely equitable and much cheaper, and that ended up working out really well. Like I said, I'm very open. I ended up matching my fourth choice, and I opened my match email in the drive-thru of, like, a local fast food restaurant with my boyfriend at the time in the car with me, and I am so glad that I did that. Looking back, because I was really, really upset. I thought I had, like, a shoe-in for my top choice. I had, like, sent a love letter. I got, like, a letter back from them that I was, like, reading into and was like, oh, guaranteed. And I was, like, I was just bawling in the car.
And then one of my best friends ended up calling me. We found out, surprisingly, we matched at the same place. So I 100% agree when you say that you end up where you're really meant to be and you can grow where you're planted. I do not regret my decision to train where I trained at all. If things were different, I would have put it first. I actually don't think I would have been nearly as happy at the other locations just because they were much further away from home. And ultimately, like, you have to be trained to a certain degree. And I think that there are a lot of pros and cons to different places. And so even if you feel upset, you still just need to rise to the occasion and just say, like, okay, well, this is what happened. So the machine decided that this is where I'm going. You make the best of it. And again, I was very pleased with where I ended up. I got a great education. The other part of it was, I've now done two matches where I had never been to the city before I matched in that location. I bought a house in Augusta via Zoom. I actually bought my house in Indianapolis via Zoom too with my trusted realtor. I literally for the first time visited Augusta right after match with my boyfriend just to like see the city. Thankfully, we were pretty close. I was in like just outside of Charlotte. And so it was like a 2.5 hour drive. And at least for Indiana, I had to like make the trek because I was in Georgia or South Carolina. So it's possible. Not everybody can handle that kind of stress and moving and things, but it definitely is possible to just kind of understand that there are limitations to your ability to travel and your ability to see every location. And I think programs are better equipped now to really show you what they have and who they are than they were like at the very beginning. Like I know for us in fellowship, when we do our fellow interviews, like we are trying to be as transparent as possible and make sure that you understand who we are and that you would be a good match. Again, fellowship interviews are a little bit different than residency interviews because you're not playing the numbers game as much and you're not competing with as many people. It is a little bit of an experience where you kind of get to be like slightly wined and dined. Like people do, they have to win you over a little bit more than where I feel like residency, it's like a little different. But the other thing I wanted to bring up as well, I was very fortunate during fellowship match that I matched at my first place. And after going through the residency process where I matched at my fourth place and I was really upset, I was extremely relieved and so happy to match at my first choice. But it is okay to feel sad about the places that you didn't go. Like there were opportunities and things that you have to try and consider. Like, okay, I have to imagine myself happy at all of these places that I'm ranking. It is okay to like mourn that life that you possibly could have left, like lived and opportunities you possibly could have had in those places. And I think that it's hard sometimes to kind of square that circle when you're like, I should be so, so happy, but I have really mixed emotions. And I think that those are completely valid emotions.
You know, I think you bring up an absolutely phenomenal point. And that is the student brings a lot to the residency, as well as the residency giving a lot to the student. It is a two-way interaction. And, you know, many times I've always told my students, listen, when you walk out of a residency, you better hope that you've done a good enough job to make it a better residency. And I so applaud you for saying that because, you know, yeah, you could be sad about what you missed, but you need to be ecstatic about what you left behind. And what you left behind is a great mark to make that a better residency. It is a two-way street. It's always been a two-way street. And when you think about your story about getting I obviously was way before the match ever really occurred. There was an osteopathic match and an allopathic match, and I didn't get into what I wanted to do either. And I had my mentor said, "Hey, come over and just do pediatrics. And until you figure out what you want to do." And, you know, obviously that's really what I needed to be doing. And it's been a phenomenal journey in my life. And I've been a very blessed man, but I think the students need to understand that they bring something to the program. They bring the knowledge, the energy, the enthusiasm to their program, whatever program that is. And when they walk out of that program 3 years later, headed for a career in pediatrics or a career in whatever, another fellowship or something, they need to really be proud of what they've left behind, because it's true to me, a true mark of what we've taught you to be as an osteopathic physician. And it's reflective of not only your character, your college's commitment to your education, and now you leave a huge footprint behind. And I really applaud you, McKenzie, for saying that. That is an excellent point that I don't want to leave behind or just leave kind of unknown.
Madison, let me ask you this. Has intern year been what you expected?
Well, here's a story. Here's a story. So July 1st, so I started on medicine. So I started adult wards at the hospital first. I got 55 pages by 1 p.m. I was like crushed. And
welcome to medicine.
I was like, this is the worst. I was like, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. And I think to cap it all off, we weren't even called that day. We were called the next day. And I was at the hospital till late. And then when I tried to leave the parking garage, my parking pass wouldn't scan. So then I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be stuck here. I can't live here. Like, this is unfair. And like, I came home and I think I sat down and I told my wife, I was like, I can't do it anymore. And she was like, it was day one and we were called the next day. And I was like, I can't do this. And then it got better every day. It gets better every day. And I'm now back on university hospital service with the adults. So for those of you listening, if you're thinking about med peds or haven't, just curious, we switch every 4 or 2 months. So I did 4 months of adult, 4 months of pediatric, and then I've switched back to the adult side. So this is my first time doing inpatient adult medicine in 4 months, like when I was at the VA. So, you know, going from RSV bronchiolitis to brain mets in an 85-year-old is kind of a big jump. But, you know, yesterday there were a couple bumps, but it wasn't July 1st. Not even close. I mean, just the comfortability you're going to get with your system, with your staff, with your knowledge. Things start crawling out of the woodwork in your brain. You'll see a lab, you'll see an image, and you're going to just... things are going to activate. You didn't know we're back there from step one or step two or whatever you took. They played this video during my peds, the orientation when we were with the pediatrics program. I think it was from Duke women's basketball. And it was, you know, there's no bit. It's like the coach was saying, you know, when's it going to be easier? You guys are saying, when's it going to be easier? It's never going to be easier. It's just going to be less hard than the day before because you have experience and you worked for it. And that's what it's been every day. I mean, I'm still learning every day. We are all still learning every day, but it's definitely easier than the day before.
So Madison, when my students say, oh my God, this is just unbelievable in the four walls, the college that you graduate from, is the four walls easier?
No, it's just different. It's a different type of hard. I mean, maybe you take a long study day that you're doing in dedicated, or a long day, hard day where you had a complicated scenario. And then I have a day where I got to see 12 patients in clinic, and then I'm going to go to conference, and then I'm going to go do this. And so it's just a different thing. And, you know, could I go back and study for step one, step two? Probably not. Probably not. I did just pass level three, so I'm done with that. But I'll be very honest. I scored below average in obstetrics and gynecology because it's not really on med peds stuff. So gave my best shot. But
you passed, and that's what's important.
But I did. Yes. So within the four walls, yeah, it's hard. Every day is going to be hard, not just in medicine, but just in your life. It's just different types of challenges, and you conquer them every day. You just may not realize it.
Yeah, it's definitely different hard in the way of like, it's just like physically harder. Like, it's not like you're sitting down at the computer for 12 hours and like
watching sketchy or like reading a book or sitting in lecture. Like you're just physically doing a lot more. But I will say it's a more enjoyable, difficult time. Like you're actually doing what you would like to do.
I think it's more rewarding too. Like you sit all day and you study and you get a grade on a test and you're like, okay, it was great, or okay, that wasn't my best. But when you're outside those four walls of med school and in the four walls of the hospital, you're, you know, watching a kid who's been admitted for 280 days go to a foster home, right? And that's like a moment that is rewarding, that sticks with you differently. Like, I don't remember what I got on any exam in medical school, but I will remember when she left the hospital, right? So I think physically, mentally, emotionally, it stretches you in different ways, but you know how to overcome that because of the challenges you went through in med school. And you know how, like, you function in the face of adversity.
And, you know, what's interesting, I'm sorry, Madison, but what's also interesting is that I'm sure as my entire career, no one ever asked me what I scored on boards, or what I scored on my first anatomy test, or what I, you know, had as where I ranked in my class.
I could tell you I scored a 100% on my anatomy final, but that's just me.
Iconic.
Yeah. Like when you're a patient, when someone in a room, a person looks at you and says like, I trust you, thank you. And they call you their doctor, and like you see this look in your face. I mean, it just hits different. It's kind of scary when they say, I trust you, and that's a big moral responsibility. But I mean, like when you get these genuine thank yous, even for really just hard things, poor diagnoses, poor prognoses, like it definitely fills the emotional wellness. Yes. And to answer Dr. Jackson's earlier question, I'm making my schedule for second year and I'm trying to figure out where to put adult cardiac ICU. And there's no good options.
Madison, you bring up a good point. One of the things that is, you know, as an academician and a pediatrician, I've been both for the last 10 years up till January of this year. But one of the things that really strikes me is that the last two words as I walk out of a room, and it is, thank you. That is something that I, you know, it's a lot of the students are doing now. I mean, they really are. They're focusing in on understanding where their education is coming from, at least from a clinical standpoint, and they're appreciative of it. But that's one thing that I've seen where the parents have always said to me is, thank you, Dr. Cyrus. And it is something that is humbling to some degree, but is a responsibility to another degree. And I always feel like I want to put forth the very best I can. And that puts, you know, that puts the onus on me to make sure that as I step out of my residency or step into another into my career field, that I continue my education, because so many things, oh my God, over the last 30 years, it's just amazing how many things have changed to me. It's just phenomenal. And you all will be a part of that. You things 30 years from now, things are going to be, you know, unbelievably changed.
I think you bring up a good point there in terms of like that time period between match and when you start, because the idea of excitement. Now you officially aren't a student doctor, you're a doctor, and introducing yourself is going to change intern year, which, by the way, start practicing now, because it is a really hard switch to make when you introduce yourself and it feels so weird. But you're kind of, I don't want to say feeling almighty, but right, like you made this major milestone, you've worked really hard, you've matched into somewhere, or you're doing your transitional year. And then you step in day one of residency, like Madison, you get very humbled very quickly. And so I think keeping that in perspective during this time of like, yes, you did it, but also now you have this huge responsibility that is terrifying. But it does get better as you become a senior, I will say.
Yes, it does. And I'll say, so for well, more for Mackenzie, because I know you're coming right around that corner. Wait till someone asks you a question and you can't say, hold on, let me go talk to my attending. And that's when you really get humble.
I love now that I've learned that the attendings all say, you know, let's circle back on that this afternoon. And, think about that and we'll we'll reassess clinically.
And for the med students, when your attending says, why don't you read up on that and tell us about it tomorrow? That's because they have no idea. Okay? We have no idea. And we are going to 100% scapegoat install. Okay.
One of the most humbling moments in my career was the time that I saw something that I never saw in residency or in med school. And, you know, it's one of those things in time that you can't see everything in your residency. There's no residency that has everything, but it's when you see something that in your gut you say, this is not right. Whatever child it is, whatever parent you have to advocate against, maybe it's a really, really wake up moment that you say, wow, you know, I've seen only one Munchausen's by proxy in my entire career. And it was within the first 2 years of post-residency. And it was just the most bizarre story that a parent could come up with. And it was in my gut going, this just did not happen. And I was having to call the state police to find out whether this actually did happen. It was the most bizarre story. But nevertheless, it made me, you know, again, re-up in my education and read and explore what I didn't get. I mean, because a lot of these things don't happen every day of your career.
Yeah. And along those lines, you brought up 2 points, Scott, that I want to get all of their thoughts about is, you know, there's 2 schools of thought after you've matched. I'm going to read the seminal textbook of my specialty and I'm going to know it page to page, or I'm going to do nothing but electives on the beach and I'm going to shut my brain off as much as possible. So how do you make that balance? And then how do you go from, as a medical student, you're perfectly fine saying, I don't know. But when you cross over and you put on that longer white coat and now you're a doctor, you're afraid to say, I don't know. Share your stories.
All right. I'm gonna say one thing real quick. I hope that every one of you will realize you say, I don't know, but quickly say right behind it, I'm fixing to find out.
So first question, I did the latter option and chose to turn my brain off and reset. First of all, I think reading cover to cover is just not a realistic goal. And that was a weakness that I worked on in medical school, was making realistic goals. So that aside, I think it's important to rest and reset. We kind of touched upon this earlier, but there's a lot that needs to happen in a very short amount of time in terms of your living arrangements. And are you renting a moving truck or a moving company? Saying goodbye to family? Like all of these things that adding pressure on yourself to study things that, one, you've already looked at, and two, there's nothing that's academically going to change in those few months. But what is going to change is your outlook and your attitudes and your perception when you walk in feeling like a breath of fresh air into residency. That's just my 2 cents. And yes, I prefer on a beach, not in the mountains. And the second question, I say I don't know as even a second year resident every single day. Every single day. I think not only is that a natural thing to say, but I think what I've learned from intern year to now is that parents or patients aren't looking at you negatively when you say, I don't know. They're comforted by the fact that you say, I don't know, let me go find out and I'll come back, because that phrase lets them know that you are giving them actual solid information and not just something you picked out of a brain cell. There's a lot of things I've seen in pediatrics and a lot of those rare one-off cases, but there's also a lot of bread and butter. And so saying I don't know, even for, you know, the kid who's had their sixth ear infection and they're like, do my kid need tubes? I don't know. Oh, but let me send you to ENT and they can have that conversation with you. Or this is my thought, but XYZ. I say, I have medical education is the current elective that I'm on. And I was learning about feedback and they were like, what would you say to this person? And I was like, I have no idea. Like, ask me to tell you how to do better on a fake code where the patient passed away. I have no idea. But yes, I think that's a very important skill to have.
I love that your program does a med-ed elective.
Oh my gosh, I am thriving.
That sounds like an excellent elective to learn those skills.
We're also starting a med-ed track, which will allow you to sprinkle it in throughout your residency.
Sweet. Very nice.
So it's a little bit different now that I'm in fellowship, because when you come into fellowship, it's a little bit, you have some foundation. So even if your questions that are being asked of you, you can at least lean back on some of that pediatrics knowledge that you have acquired during your residency. Thinking back towards what I experienced in like the beginning of intern year, it's a lot of like being okay with being uncomfortable and being okay with like not necessarily feeling like the best doctor, because you're still just trying to like baby step your way through things and being really upfront with like what you don't know is an extremely hard skill. And it was something that I had to learn a lot through medical school and to be comfortable with and really struggle with through residency too, because you feel like the pressure is that you should know everything, that you should be reading constantly, learning constantly, be able to perform at the peak best resident that you possibly could be, which is just not reasonable. It's just not feasible. And learning to give yourself grace is like a really important skill as you go through residency. I feel like for me, when I started fellowship, a lot of it is kind of faking it till you make it. You know, you usually get a little bit comfortable by that point. I would say even some of second year, really, you have this projected confidence that you're like, well, I'm not the bottom of the barrel anymore. And I have a little bit that I know, and I know that, you know, you can finagle your way through it. And when you get into those places, I would say the important next thing after becoming comfortable with being like, I can't possibly know everything, the next step is to really understand. Oh, that's a baby. The next step is to really understand what your resources are and who you can lean on and who will be there beside you. Like for me in the NICU, our APPs, we've had some since I was like, they've been practicing as long as I've been alive, and they are incredible wealth of knowledge. And neonatal APPs and like NNPs are a little bit different of a breed, I feel like, in some ways than the other APPs, just because we can be very intense and you have to kind of be that. But it's really understanding that like the hierarchy of the team exists, but it doesn't necessarily matter when it comes to patient care. So if you need to figure out the best way to do something for your patient, it doesn't matter if you're the attending or the resident or the nurse practitioner or the nurse. Like, we are all working together to share that knowledge. And so there's many, many things that I'm like, I honestly have no idea. And there are things that it's just going to take time, and we just kind of have to sit here and have multiple conversations about to really work through difficult conversations. So I think it's just working through that next level is what I'm doing now.
And along that line, for all of you graduating medical students and for all of you on here, if a nurse practitioner offers to show you how to do a procedure, you say yes and thank you. Because I can tell you right now, I have not put in a PICC line in 9 years. You say yes and thank you, because they are the ones who are on the front lines doing that work.
Yes, I would tell you, a respiratory therapist taught me how to intubate a baby.
Yeah, and There are times where, you know, like, I truly could not even begin to, like, procedural things. I famously always tell people, like, they're like, how do we do this procedural thing? Like, it, like, a family that's like, what is this like? How do you set up the NICU camera? Like, how do you do? I'm like, that is above my pay grade. You're going to have to talk to your nurse. Like, they're the wealth of knowledge for you at bedside. And they actually have so much knowledge that they can share with families that they're like, well, we talked about X, Y, and Z things. It's like, oh, well, what did you want me to say? Because you kind of already said it all. Like, there are, you know, really wonderful members of our teams that we can rely on in ways that it's not like breaking the structure that you feel like you get. Like, you definitely feel like you should know more than the people around you, like your nursing staff or in mid-levels, because you're the doctor, you're the resident. But that just doesn't exist.
I mean, it's so true, because you try to think about an EEG tech that's setting up for, there would be no way I could put an EEG leads on this child's head. There's just no way. And yet they walk in there and they put the, you know, 26 or whatever leads there are on a child's head, and you can have a video EEG for the next 24 to 48 hours.
I will always trust a respiratory therapist above anybody else listening to a patient.
And never touch the vent. Never.
No.
The vent.
Gosh, no.
Madison, you have not gotten to answer how you spent your time between Matt.
I did nothing. I went to the beach. I went to the mountains. I did take care of my wife after she got her meniscus fixed, and rented a U-Haul and drove that and did all those things. And I had fun. Like, part of all of the students listening to this, or anyone listening to this, is when you go on this interview journey and you're looking for the program and et cetera, you know, like, you can have the wealth of knowledge, but if you don't have things like bedside manner, if you don't have a willingness to learn, to read the room, to counsel, to be a team player, your wealth of knowledge can only get you so far before interpersonal skills fail you. So you can read all the books you want between graduation and intern start on July 1st. But unless your patient has the one thing you're reading, which, trust me, after you get 55 pages, it doesn't matter what you read, because you're going to be so busy answering them, you have time. But, like, you just do nothing. Relax. It's one of those few periods in your life where you're going to have a lot of control over your time versus the schedule of residency. And I'm still able to take vacations. And I just skied for a week, and my wife and I are going to the beach in a few months. But I have much more constraints and rigidity. I have to train and learn and graduate. And so take that time and just live your best life. Everyone has said it. It is okay to say you don't know. I think my biggest thing in training so far has been, if I'm going into a room or an encounter where I'm not, I don't know the prognosis or the final answer. I don't know some aspect of what's about to happen. Always, like we've talked about, having that, what is our alternate path, or what is our next step? I had a patient at the VA who had a very poor cancer prognosis made while he was my patient on service. And we had some initial imaging, but it hadn't quite set the stage yet for, like, metastasis and such. And his daughter is like, you know, there are questions about, is this cancer? That's the big one. Is this cancer? And you have to say, I don't know yet. I know something is there that is abnormal, and our next step is to do this. We have found A, we're going to proceed to step B, and we're going to do this. And I think you have to set this, you learn to set this with the patients and the team and everyone, is to sometimes think very linearly and not run away mentally with the anxiety or the stress of what could be happening, where you have to go sort of stepwise about, well, what about chemo and radiation? You have to step back and say, well, this is what we're going to do first. And that sort of helps keep the tone. But it is okay to say you don't know. I say it all the time. I say it to my wife. She probably hates me when I say it.
You know, but, Madison, you bring up a good point, you know, to say I'm not sure, or, you know, sometimes what I did was, I didn't avoid the question. I just didn't necessarily answer the question. And we need to do further testing before we could answer that question. or we need to delve further into the his condition or her condition before we can truly answer that question. Even though in the back of my mind, I was highly suspicious of an unfortunate diagnosis. I mean, when dealing with children and you have a child who walks in or doesn't really walk in, but at 18 months is crawling into your, or 3 years crawling into your office, and you kind of think, wow, that child's really small, really large to be crawling into my office. And they are, you know, they have all the neurological signs, a brain tumor, and you're highly suspicious of a brain tumor. Many times I have taken the road to say, you know, mom, I'm really highly suspicious. I'm very concerned about, you know, there's something going on here. Not necessarily naming what it is, but very concerned about something that's seriously going on here. We need to do further testing before we just open up the floodgates. I've had so many doctors and I've had so many parents come to me and say, well, the last doctor we were at said he had Down syndrome and we were all worried about having Down habit. And so we went through this whole roller coaster of emotions and we wanted to come see you. And so my advice when you don't know is don't think about the worst thing there is. Think about the side of the parent and say, what emotion are you going to put this parent through when you say, I think he has X, Y, or Z? I've always felt like until I am, you know, absolutely 100% sure, I'm 99% sure, but until I'm 100% sure that I'm going to put these parents through maybe hours, if not days worth of agony, trying to make sure that they actually have it. So in my entire career, I've always said, I'm really concerned there's something, you know, seriously going on here. What it is, I'm not 100% right now, but moving forward, we're going to find out, you know.
So on a lighter note, as we've been sitting here talking about tumors, I'm looking through. So for those of you who don't get the DO Magazine emails, there was actually a very timely article that came out today that was the 5 things I wish I knew in between match and starting residency. So I wish I could do video thumbs up or thumbs down on some of these, but I guess we can do maybe you can rank them after I give them to you. But one is find out the secrets of your electronic medical record system. 2 was start thinking in terms of assessment and plans and order sets instead of, you know, diagnoses. I'm going to skip 3. 4 was get a conference schedule and some vignette templates for research. 5, we've hit on 5 a lot. Figure yourself out, take time to relax, and do some things that you love. I think we can all agree that as a thumbs up. The one we have not talked about yet is learn some personal finance habits. How did you all make the transition to all of a sudden getting paid for what you do?
I'm still struggling.
Honest.
I mean, we're still always like, I call it balling on a budget, you know, just like U of L Health has a gym on the medical campus that we get access to with our employee ID. Like and thank God my father-in-law does my taxes. He's a CPA accounting professor. But I mean, yeah, even when it's small, when you get that first little bit of money, it's very nice. It's okay to buy yourself. It's okay to give yourself a little treat when you start. You have worked very hard. You know, I think med school itself teaches a lot of frugality, right? Because you are working and studying a great deal and not making any income. In fact, you're paying to do those things. So we've tried to keep that same mentality. Yes, and that's true. I decided to start growing out my hair 4th year of med school, and getting those haircuts will save money. And you can buy Legos with that money. So,
oh, did you buy a Death Star?
I bought the Ultimate Collector Series Venator. It's up there on top of the kitchen.
Okay.
I donated my plasma at a blood cancer center for 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
So I will say my program director now as a fellow is like a money guru. And so he does a lot of like financial teaching for us. When I moved to Augusta, I thought it was cheaper to buy a house and pay a mortgage payment than it was to rent. And so what was cheaper for me to do the physician's loan and buy my house. And I learned a whole heck of a lot through that. And I do think that is a very valid option for housing during residency, especially if you have the ability to do so in credit and in your paycheck. I think the physician loan is something very interesting to look into. There are plenty of things that are so expensive and are nice to be able to give yourself, but really choosing to live as frugal as possible is the only way to really do that. And it gets better.
I think what I've learned over the years of that I've been, you know, from student to resident or intern, rotating internship to resident to attending, it just seems like what you want is about 10% more than what you make.
So, that feels right.
But one of the things that I was fortunate enough to be involved with was in our internship year, right out of med school, in our internship year, we actually had what we called a grand rounds financial health. It was called fiscal financial health. And it brought in a financial planner that started from day, almost, you know, year one, at least, not day one, but at least year one, and talked about how do we save? How do we, you know, put away for retirement? How do we plan for those years that I'm now semi looking at? And it turned out to be really something that has been very beneficial to me, very beneficial. So I would encourage, as you get out into your first year of residency, you know, you need to start planning for retirement, because right now, if you plan for retirement now, it's so much easier than if you plan for retirement 20 years from now.
I have a whole bunch of scratch off tickets that I'm just waiting
to turn the right age to scratch off and hope for the best.
The lottery and scratch off tickets were not in that guy's portfolio.
Oh, really? That's crazy.
I should have sat in that class.
I will say the one thing that I remember distinctly that we always brought up, one of our financial literacy, exiting medical school classes that we had to take, was about like how much money you spend on frivolous things and how that compounds with your loan payments and all those things of like one coffee is going to cost you like $17,000. You know, I think it's really difficult to put a lot of expectations on yourself, especially when you start residency and you're getting that first paycheck. It is completely fair and valid to give yourself a little treat. Like, you could treat yourself whenever you need to, and it is okay to do that, and you don't have to feel guilty about that. I just wanted to say that really quick.
Well, along that lines, and which we did have, we lost, it was interesting as you were talking about the troubles of homeownership. Dr. Kraft put into our chat, I have to hop off unexpectedly for a housing emergency. So welcome to homeownership. So what, if you don't mind me asking, I remember what mine was. Mine was a pair of Dolce & Gabbana sunglasses. I also was living in Miami, so like I needed sunglasses. So what was that first paycheck treat that you ladies gave yourselves? I'd ask Scott, but you know, I would basically be like starting to give him that ball tree penguin test, right?
So, well, you got to realize I waited in med school with two children, a family and two children. I came out of med school with a family and three children. So there was,
well, your treat was diapers.
Yeah, my treat was diapers and formula.
Yeah, formula is expensive. Not my exact first paycheck, because I put the money to save, but I got my dogs. That was a big purchase. And I think I put half my paycheck, first paycheck, away for him, and probably realized that how it goes a little bit too much to put away at once.
But then 3-4 months into residency, we got him. And he's staring at me now because he's like, you're talking about me? But yes, a puppy. May or may not recommend doing that, but we didn't.
Listen, you do crazy things in residency. During my second year, actually the back half of my second year, I had a really light schedule. And so I started fostering puppies. So, I mean, you can just do crazy stuff in residency. I foster failed with my very last one and she still lives with us. I entered residency with 2 dogs and left with 3. Yeah, they're spoiled the same way, I'm sure. I'm trying to remember exactly what I spent a lot of my money on at the very beginning. I do not remember at the beginning of residency. Like, that whole intern year, I remember, like, bits and pieces. Don't remember much of anything else.
Yeah, I was trying to block it out.
Yeah. For fellowship, one of the first things, I honestly spent my first paycheck like exploring my city, like going out to a lot of restaurants, really getting to know my city and going, like, feeling okay to, like, go out with my co-fellows and explore the city and not feel guilty about, like, indulging in being in a position where I had time and energy, which is crazy that fellowship is like that. You got time and energy to have hobbies again. It's crazy. But to really indulge in, like, being a person.
I will say our program here also does value that. Nothing against the program that I trained. If any of my co-fellows are listening to this, that was not the culture there. But I did refine books when I came here as an attending. I want to give a chance to you to talk about if there was either one piece of advice that you wish you had heard for our soon-to-be graduates.
I'll go. I kind of said it earlier, and the ACOP conference, this is going to be part of what I talk about for our match talk. So my biggest thing is definitely grow where you're planted. Like, it's going to be okay. It is not the end of the world, no matter where you match. I've had friends that match their number one. I've had friends that match their 9th place across the country. Like, you choose to grow where you're planted. You choose to make the best of any situation that you're put in and really take time for yourself during this time frame between match and starting residency to find peace about it, especially if it's not what you were hoping for, or maybe it is what you were sort of hoping for, but there's other things that you were kind of expecting and there's a lot of emotions about match that aren't just happy emotions. And it's totally okay to feel those things, but really just taking this time to come to terms with that. And then the other thing that I would say is to indulge in things that you're never going to do again. I was going to mention this earlier, and it was the part of the question I didn't remember. I chose to do a lot of things in the back half of my 4th year that were, like, adult medicine things that I was like, I'm literally never going to be in a, like, adult hem-onc office again. Let me just figure out how to do, like, a slide and, like, look at blood cells. Like, there's things that I did during that time frame that actually were helpful and did feed me in my, like, you know, like, information that I've used in residency and some in fellowship that, you know, I was never ever going to do those things again. So might as well do it now.
Yes. During my time after match, I got to use a bone saw and amputate a leg. The attendee was like, have you ever cut someone's leg off? I was like, no. He's like, here you go. Now you can say you have. And I'm like, okay.
Sir, I'm going into pediatrics.
All right, Dr. Croner.
Okay, so I don't remember which order you said them in, but one thing I wish I was told, similarly to what Mackenzie was saying, but, and I try and tell myself this, but it's nice to hear other people say it, is everything will work out and everything is that's meant to be will be. And trust in that process. Trust yourself and trust your education and your knowledge. You didn't get here just on a whim. Like, you worked really, really hard. And so I wish somebody told me that in the very beginning. And then my piece of advice that I love to tell in the med ed world is to never stop loving learning and to never stop being who you are and following your passions, because the more you follow your passions, like for me, medical education, like the more you ignite the spark in you to continue doing this hard work that we do, because not every day is rainbows and unicorns. And so having those outlets is really important for the harder times. So find what you love to do now.
Scott, I know you want to say something, but I'm going to ask you a question first.
All right, go ahead.
As an academician, as a chair of pediatrics, what is the advice that you give your graduating students on the day after they've matched? And you look at them and you'd say, if there's one piece of advice I could give you, it is this. And then you can say whatever you want after that.
All right. As I say, that's an easy question because it's what I tell everybody, and that is celebrate your successes. I mean, so it is, I mean, it is, it, to me, it's the theme of tonight. You know, whether like Jessica said, it's your first or your ninth, it's a success. And you need to celebrate that success. You need to be proud of yourself. You need to pat yourself on the back. No matter if anybody else pat you on the back or not, you need to pat yourself on the back. You need to have the confidence. You need to have the love of yourself to say, I am successful. You know, to me, the life is like a staircase. You climb up, you get to a senior in high school, and then you flatten out and you run over to the next tread. And then you go up a little further and you get to be a senior in college. And then you go over to the next tread and you go up to be a senior in med school. And then you go over to the lowest rung there is a first year resident, but yet you are making progress, and you always have to believe that you're making progress. You're making advancements and you're going up in life. And there are so many times that we get down on ourselves that we're not making progress. And yet we are, through your residency, you think, oh my God, I'm never going to make it through residency. But yet you're getting the experience, and the experience takes you into maybe fellowship, and your fellowship takes you into becoming an attending. And never expect. And you know, I'm not sure whether it was McKenzie or Jessica that said lifelong learning, that you always have to think about lifelong learning. The things that you don't see in residency that you're faced with in your career, you have to say, you know, I may not know now, but I know it's southern border, but it's fixing to find out. You know, I am fixing to find out. I am going to challenge myself to look in the books, to look it up on whatever resource we can find, because it is not about it. It is somewhat about you, but it's about your patient. It is about that accountability you have to your patient. You have that love and that humble feeling that you are doing the very best for your patient. And when you have a tough day at school or at work, or you have a tough day at the hospital, you know, to me, that was always a normal day. When it became unicorns and puppy dogs, that was the day that I, you know, really celebrated. But sometimes I celebrated the day that I just got through a tough day. My brain, I used to say, I used to come home and I'd tell my wife, my brain is tired. My brain is completely tired, and I may go to bed early. I may just sit here and veg out for a little bit, but right now my brain's tired. And the fact that I got through that day and my patients all got what they deserved, they got, you know, set out on their pathway, be it an antibiotic or an admission to the hospital or whatever, that's what I celebrated. And I celebrated it because I knew I had done a good job. Whether I knew all the answers, no, maybe I didn't know all the answers, but I knew I had done a good job, and I gave my patients my very best. And I would only say to you, think about what you do for your patients, and you will be honored in the past, in the future, and you will be, you know, looking forward to every day making a career in pediatrics or med peds or whatever you decide, it'll be your joy in life. You won't ever go to work, because whatever you do, you enjoy it to its fullest.
I want to thank you, Dr. Kroner, and Dr. LeMay, and Dr. Kraft. I would be remiss as this is the March podcast and it is going to be airing before you all join me, are you all excited to come to Columbus?
And Jason, we'd be kind of remiss to not to mention about DO Day on the Hill. You know, we advocate for our pediatric patients because they have a very difficult voice. They don't vote and sometimes they don't talk. But we as pediatricians must always advocate for our patients, and be it on the local level, the state level, and with DO Day on the Hill, we do it on the federal level and the national level.
With that, I can't wait to see you all in Columbus, but I want to thank you for sharing your expertise and your words of wisdom and your time with Scott and I and with our listeners. Does anyone have any closing thoughts, remarks? Oh, Scott's got one more.
I do, and that is, I want to wish everyone, I know this is going to be post-match, but I really wish for everyone to get the match they wish for and success in the future, because you are our future. We are excited to see thousands DO students graduate and set into a career of medicine. So I'm proud of you. I want you to be successful, and you could always reach out to Jason or I to ask questions, to be a podcast participant. We'd just love to have you on to tell us your experiences through your journey.
Yes. And with that, Merry Matchmas to all of my fourth-year students that are out there. For those of you who are making the journey to Columbus, come by and say hi. Obviously, we're all going to be there. And I hear there's a great student track that's going to be going on. They have me in the hot seat for an hour and a half on Sunday. So I'll be talking to you about advocacy. Otherwise, Scott, always a pleasure. And listeners, thank you for sticking with us. Make sure to like, subscribe, tell your friends. If you don't like us, tell your enemies. But we will see you again. Maybe we'll see you again in April. Scott, we'll have to talk about that because I have some international conferences I'm headed to in April. But we're going to try to get one. We're going to try to get one out to you in April. But everyone, enjoy the turn of spring. And hopefully we'll see you in Columbus. The ACOP PEDScast podcast series is the official podcast of the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians. Your hosts are Jason Jackson DO and Scott Cyrus DO, edited by Jason Jackson. Original music by James Cyrus of Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any requests for topics or you'd like to be a guest on the PEDScast podcast series, please email us at PEDScast. PEDScast@acopeds.org